Good morning. You're listening to WTUL News and Views. I'm Nora, and this Monday morning we'll hear more about the national and world news on Counterspin at 8:30 and Democracy Now! At 9. Thank you for tuning in this morning as I replay a 2011 podcast from Alan Clear with the Harm Reduction Coalition. It's called Race, Patriarchy, and Pleasure. In this conversation, we'll hear about white supremacy and patriarchy, pain and pleasure, healing ourselves, and organizing to heal collectively. It's a poignant piece as New Orleanians experience heightened awareness of social justice issues and rally toward more equitable futures. As background, the conversation centers around two women who work in harm reduction. What is harm reduction? Harm reduction is defined as a set of practical strategies that reduce the negative consequences of drug use, incorporating a spectrum of strategies from safer use to managed use to abstinence. Harm reduction strategies meet drug users where they're at. There is an important need for harm reduction in order to reduce stigma associated with drug use, to increase trust and improve relationships with people in our communities who use drugs, and to improve not only individual health, but community health. In New York, where this conversation took place, harm reduction has been used to address HIV, hepatitis C, and overdose, and to focus on treatment rather than criminalization.
Welcome back to the Harm Reduction Coalition podcast. My name is Alan Clear and I work for the Harm Reduction Coalition. This week we have two interviews, one with Asha Bandeli from Drug Policy Alliance.
When you look at every black girl who's out there who's a superstar who still has to put on a blonde wig or blonde weave to get out there and perform, says we still don't love even what we look like. We're still fighting for that.
And we talk race, community, and the upcoming Drug Policy Alliance conference. I also talked to Joyce Rivera, Executive Director of St. Anne's Corner Harm Reduction.
You know, I mean, drug-using women are still living in patriarchal society where drug-using men still dominate drug-using women.
And we talk about patriarchy, women, and pleasure. Hi, Asha.
Hi, Alan.
What a lot of people don't know is that we've been in each other's lives since the early 80s, when we had lots of mutual friends and used to hang out in the same place.
It's true. You were a bartender at a place we used to go to, and one of the things I always explain to people is seeing you in this movement now reminds me every day how important it is that we continue to do this work and push it to be as strong, robust, and relevant as possible, because the people who we knew then, many of them are dead now. They're dead because of AIDS, or they were dead because of drugs. They're dead because there wasn't any kind of harm reduction movement. There wasn't anybody saying, let's embrace. It was only, let's stigmatize. And so it just tells you about the urgency of what has to happen. Nobody deserved to die because they used drugs or because they were gay.
Yeah, that's right. One of the first person I know that died of AIDS was someone we both loved at that time, you know. And it's funny to think back to then. And it's also everyone we knew was sort of strung out in some ways. Well, they were strung out. There was people who had drug habits, and there was no conversation about that whatsoever.
Well, there was no conversation about also the kinds of things that that open people up to struggling with drugs and drug use or misuse, right? So you didn't have an Oprah Winfrey on the air then, and I think that even with having all these sort of talk shows out there where things are handled usually poorly rather than well, is that a lot of times, you know, first of all, there's never been a society where we didn't use drugs. And most of the times when people are using drugs, there is an element where people just want to have fun. But a lot of it is trying to mitigate pain. And we don't have very much in this world that is about pain management, truly getting to the core of something. Who can afford therapy at $200 a pop that's not covered on health insurance? Who, if you even have health insurance? There's so much out there that doesn't deal with a proactive response to it. So in many ways, we get reactive responses to it, whether it's through using alcohol or other drugs, whether it's through sex addiction, whether it's through eating too many McDonald's French fries. I don't care what it is. People are shopping, gambling, you name it. We've got it here. And whether we criminalize it or we look at it for what it is, a health crisis, where we can actually save people's lives is really the question before us now.
Yeah, not just their lives, but their mental health in some ways, because the pain and trauma is so deep rooted and deep seated that you know there's not much that can dig that out, and it's, you know, especially in the conditions people live under now. And I remember when we got into needle exchange and harm reduction early, you know, late '80s, early '90s, the deep seated resistance within the African American community to syringe exchange was very pronounced, you know, that here was an intervention that was coming along that's like another thing you're going to do in our community. And now things have changed a little bit over time.
Well, you know, it's a deep question. I go through some of this now with friends who, like me, grew up in areas where we saw the neighborhood turn over to crack. I mean, with syringe exchange and the association it has with heroin, we had seen communities devastated post-Vietnam because of an extraordinary amount of heroin misuse, right, that came out of that war, no treatment for those soldiers who were returning home, many of them. And so I think that when you couple that trauma that existed within families and neighborhoods, and you also think about the shame that often we feel just sort of living while black, right? And we see it all the times. And, you know, this idiot just put something out on Psychology Today that says definitively this is why he knows black women are the ugliest women on the planet. I mean, there's so much that goes on with being black. Yes, this is a real thing. But London School of Economics professor said he did a definitive study. And, of course, it was rebuked and it got taken down. But that Psychology Today would even allow that to run shows you the depth of what we're still struggling with. When you look at every black girl who's out there who's a superstar who still has to put on a blonde wig or blonde weave to get out there and perform, says we still don't love even what we look like. We're still fighting for that. So when you add to that internalized shame that extends going back generations, right? Some would argue it goes, you know, we never recovered from the effects of slavery psychologically. Mm-hmm. And when you add to that the stigma that is society-wide, that's nationwide, no matter what race, class, or culture, that comes with using drugs that are considered illicit drugs, like especially like heroin, I mean, you know, nobody wants to talk about it until, you know, you get to a point that you start seeing, you know, the incursion of AIDS, and you start seeing the kind of deaths in our community. And I think that, you know, the question that Ethan Nadelman, you know, for whom I work here at Drug Policy Alliance, asked the central question, which is, what is the cost of a slow learning curve? And so I very much see part of my role in this work as a black woman figuring out how we reduce that learning curve time, because part of it is also on the drug policy reform movement and having a way to talk to diverse communities, understanding, you know, the trauma effects and impact that people have lived through, suffered under, and died under, so that when we go out and we talk about it, we're talking about it in a way that respects people's individual culture, lives, and experiences, which I don't know has always happened. I don't know that we've always had, or that we have now, the most robust movement, the most diverse movement. And without that kind of many-voiced, you know, movement, not everybody hears our messaging. So that's the responsibility on our side. The responsibility on the side of my community is to really look at questions like, what would you rather have? Would you rather have somebody who maybe was struggling with drugs but who was very much alive and not infecting people with AIDS potentially? Or would you rather just write him off, talk about him, stigmatize him, and then he or she dies and perhaps take some other people with him, right? Because that's the cost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's like historically you had the counterculture and the resistance that came out of the Vietnam War and like the riots in the late 60s. So you had the Black Panthers and the Young Lords. It's like the whole resistance that came from the community, and then we had the whole war on drugs and Nixon and incarceration and Reagan. It's like it's really understandable why there was a resistance to something like syringe exchange, because like here's another way of facilitating people killing themselves within our communities, which are devastated. And I think in some ways it's for all communities, no matter which community, it's kind of like looking at a harm reduction approach or reform to the drug laws and drug policy, and then looking at the harms of drug laws in general. It's like, how can we turn this on its head? You know, because remember you talked about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It's well-founded sort of documentation about why the influx of drugs appeared in communities of color, you know. So then next thing you know, we're giving people syringes, you know. It sort of all ties in. So yeah, the dialogue within black community is very different than what it would be in the white community. It's like there's a historical precedence that we don't have. And it's sort of well-founded. So it's like people like yourself, and it's like we're developing this language and dialogue as to how to undo the damage that's been done. It's sort of like a big knot, right? We've compounded one issue with another issue and another issue. You can't actually see the cause and roots and why things are the way they are, sort of.
Well, I think you know that that's just right. And, you know, I was talking with somebody after we did a New Directions conference, which looks at a harm reduction approach in Newark. And, you know, it's one thing to say we're just going to move to a public health approach, which I agree with. And you know, the reduction in sort of the police presence and having the over-policing that drives incarceration numbers often unfairly, generally unfairly. It's another thing to be the grandma who's taking care of a couple of kids, and there might be shooting on either floors or, you know, whatever kind of activity going on that makes you afraid to walk out of your house. I can certainly remember in the 90s where I lived, which was right sort of in Crack Central in Brooklyn. I lived in a ground floor apartment. One night specifically, but I'm sure it was more than one night, sleeping on the floor because there was so much gunfire. And I think it was probably just kids shooting off the roof and playing, but that's how prevalent guns were. So when you've had drugs used as a weapon of genocide, it feels like, you know, against your community, it is very hard to come in with something like syringe exchange, and perhaps the groundwork hadn't been done to have those kinds of dialogues. How do we learn from that lesson now? How do we have a little more patience around the table when someone tells a story or puts out an idea that is not quite the way that we would say it or do it? I see that disconnect all the time in the methods of organizing and how you put an idea forward. How do you develop leadership that makes sense for a group of people who maybe weren't Harvard educated, right, who developed a lot of their leadership, maybe some of them in prison, right, and maybe didn't have a college degree? I remember having that discussion, you know, with some of the conferences we went to, you know, and people wanted people's CVs and their education background. And I said,
I said, not
my people, like not everybody. And I'm somebody who has degrees, and it doesn't mean for everybody, but it means when I bring together a huge table of black organizers, I'm going to get some people who went to Harvard and some people who went to Attica. And that's just what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
And so it's really about learning how to, in our own selves, manage those different dialogues and those different voices, and assuming, I think, I always tell people, let's assume goodwill. Mm-hmm. Let's assume people come here with some similar and some shared goals so that we do not have the kind of deaths we're seeing, unneeded, unnecessary deaths. And I think how we get to that point where we assume goodwill may allow us to help open up the dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think it's difficult for people to sort of get under the skin, no pun intended here, of where people are coming from in some ways. Because I remember once being in a conversation about, you know, the ban on, you know, if you're caught drug dealing in federal housing, that you're evicted,
right?
And then it affects the whole family. And someone said how shocking that was. But they've actually never lived in housing where people are running up and down stairs all night, banging on doors with, you know, people in the stairwells and stuff. It's like there was a sort of, that was misplaced, as a sort of a logic as to why that would be. But unless you've had that experience, you don't understand how horrible that situation can be when you have dealers in your same building, on your same floor. You know, it's a different kind of experience.
And then on the other side of that, too, I mean, you do have people who live like that, but because you're not taking consultation from a broad rainbow of folks, question around the TANF bans, which is really what you're talking about, that put people out of housing, what wasn't taken into consideration, what's often called unintended consequences, is that putting a whole family out, you know, I appreciate that we need to respond to, you know, activity in the building that's making it unsafe, right? But when you put out a whole family, do you really make a community more or less safe by putting out somebody who you know is not participating in illicit activity, right? And I think that, you know, we might have been able to think those questions through better if we were not so afraid to have that kind of multi-voiced table, right? So it's not just black people, it's poor black people, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, it's people who can really expand what does it mean to live in an area where you've been criminalized, you know, but you've also been the victims of somebody who's done crime. All those folks need to be at the table so that you get, you know, someone said to me once, you know, the more multi-sided the problem, the more multi-sided the solution has to be. And so that we're thinking about real safety and long-term and not being so myopic. But it's very hard when, if you don't have all those voices in your head thinking it through, mm-hmm. to just do a knee-jerk reaction, which is often what we do.
Yeah.
Doesn't get us to the most full-bodied answer. So now you have, you know, all these folks have been put out, and you have the further criminalization of even black women, which I think has made our communities far, far less safe, right? If the exponential removal of black men made it unsafe because drug dealers were not, you know, they played dual roles, right? They were mm-hmm. also fathers, they were also uncles, you know, whatever. There were a whole bunch of other things, roles that they played. But the 888% removal of black women from 1979 to 1986, I think, oh, no, I'm sorry, 86 to 99, that removal, and you don't have mothers, and now you have children who are being parented in whatever way they can by a grandma who may, you know, be an elder, may not have the capacity to do it. What does that mean for those children? And where do they go? And, you know, there's a whole kind of, you know, effect. So I think we have to be far-sighted in our approach, and I think we need to open up our idea of who we consider an expert when we make these policy decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we talk about slow learning curve, the harm reduction drug policy movement may have a slow learning curve as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're sort of getting there, I guess. Anyway, love you.
Love you more.
And we'll speak later. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Harm Reduction Coalition podcast. My name is Alan Clear and I work for the Harm Reduction Coalition. This week we have two interviews, one with Asha Bandele from Drug Policy Alliance.
When you look at every black girl who's out there who's a superstar who still has to put on a blonde wig or blonde weave mm-hmm. to get out there and perform, says we still don't love even what we look like. We're still fighting for that.
And we talk race, community, and the upcoming Drug Policy Alliance conference. I also talked to Joyce Rivera, Executive Director of St. Anne's Corner Harm Reduction.
You know, I mean, drug-using women are still living in patriarchal society where drug-using men still dominate drug-using women.
And we talk about patriarchy, women, and pleasure. Joyce Rivera has been Executive Director of St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction since the early 90s. And I spoke to some of her peer outreach workers earlier this year, and they had this to say about Joyce.
She went through so much, you know, and because she's a woman and I always look at her as a role model, it gives me encouragement I have strength within her, looking at her, what she does daily.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Alan.
The way harm reduction has developed over the last few years and the way it's sort of heading globally and nationally, you look at the national HIV strategy and people talk about best practices, and it sort of like runs down harm reduction as a set of services. So that would be HIV testing, outreach, syringe exchange, access to drug treatment, referrals. And yet, from my point of view, where we started, and we're here at St. Anne's Corner of Harm Reduction in the Bronx, which you run, we started from a sense of community, so that we were trying to create a space for people, which was really about social inclusion. I don't know that I consciously did that. I actually suspect you did know that when you did it. And it's kind of, we picked that up as we went along. But to me, harm reduction is about social inclusion. And St. Anne's has always epitomized that for me. And tell us about St. Anne's and, you know, the way you kind of respond to that thought.
Well, I agree. It's about social justice. So, of course, it's about inclusion. And it's about, well, for me, it was about making a critique of power and making sure that all of the people that were falling ill had a voice in the community, right? I mean, they weren't just grains of sand. I mean, that's how I always saw it. I mean, I had this idea that I was really pained by the fact that there was this just mass indifference over the fact that they were dying, and nobody really cared. And I just felt a sense of rage about the injustice of that. So it's about social justice, and it's about reestablishing
you know, community. It's about everyone in the community has a voice, and you know, we're interlocutors for their voices. That's how I see my role, your role, and you know, our job is to create, to be, you know, the tongue, as it were, for communities who have a voice and who, you know, we have institutional access and we can give access to that voice. So, and everyone's important and everyone's valuable. And so that means that everyone in the community, no matter, our job is to create safety for the inclusion of every voice. And that's what we do in communities. We don't tell them what they should do. So it resonates with harm reduction, right? Because in harm reduction, we don't tell people what they ought or should do. We create safety and leave it and understand that by cultivating safety, it, you know, there's inclusion and others will come in, and that they themselves will work out what the rules are, that they, you know, they'll find their space, because that's what people in communities do.
Yeah, I think it was about, we used to talk about options as well. Yeah. We would give people options, and then you sort of assess yourself, what is the option that's going to work best for you in the current situation? And it's not like, I mean, you talk about drug users, there is a real, that drug users are a real community. There's a real network. That's how you buy drugs, that's how you use drugs, and that's how you comport your life. And I always saw that harm reduction was a way of actually providing a physical space that's sort of slightly out of the street, in a sense, and it's that safe space that you talk about. And we're the translators between dominant culture and this very vibrant culture that has been excluded deliberately, marginalized, prisoned, and left to die. When I was here a few months ago, I was talking to some of the ladies of St. Anne's, and they see you as an inspirational leader within St. Anne's. I don't know if I ever played you that, but they're like, Joyce is our leader. talk about the role of women within the drug using culture.
Well, the women. Historically, when we write about poor women, we always talk about how they're the backbone of the community, and so they have this sort of conflicted role, and they're, you know, they're struggling under a debts of, you know, everyone's debt, this debt burden that they carry, and that's all about that exclusion, right? I mean, that whole dominant and that subordinate community and how we keep them. You know, we keep them oppressed, and how we create oppression and all of that. But what we do at Satcher is that we undermine we try really hard, simply by creating safety for the inclusion of different peoples. We know that that is such a radical thing to do, that sets up a synergy that is liberating for everyone in the context, right? Because finally, you know, or over here, they can assert themselves. And one of the people that can really assert themselves here is me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's nice to be a woman that carries her... carries her tits well, mm-hmm. you know? And I think I do. And the women love that.
Mm-hmm.
And the men respect it. And it's a great place for a woman to be at, because, I mean... You know, it's a place where we create safety for women to be, you know, to get their voice. We also do it for men, too, mind you. I mean, it is a place for inclusion. But we have made sure that drug-using women are not... drug-using women are still living in patriarchal society where drug-using men still dominate drug-using women. And there are roles for them in that drug-using culture. So one of the issues is that just because they're, you know, we're in a community where we have drugs, it doesn't mean that they're not replicating and reproducing the patriarchal relations of dominations. Well, not here. Not here. They don't do that here. So and that's because there's a female leader at the agency who basically, whose whole job is to undermine that dominant paradigm of patriarchal, you know, power. And so the women, they, you know, it, you, you immediately know you're in a female-centric power place. Apart from the fact that you'll see that we have lots of vaginas up against the walls. And you'll see that's what... And our approach to reducing harm is also female-centric, right? I mean, we don't really play too much with that. We do what we have to do about, say, some services like, you know, condom and all that. But we think that it's so... I think we need to go, you know, get out of the pain. So the dominant HIV prevention, sexual prevention is about, you know, condoms. It's condom-centric, meaning it's phallic-centric. Well, that's just got to, those days are over. Because really, it's really about pleasure. Mm-hmm. I get into harm because I was looking for pleasure. And so what we do at Satcher is that we have turned all of those, that pain paradigm, that harm paradigm, into much more of a pleasure paradigm. And when I know about how I'm going to find my pleasure and that I can replicate and reproduce my pleasure, well, then maybe I really want to use that barrier. And it's the way we work with, you know, what we've done with, say, syringes. We don't really have to tell people that they need to clean syringes so long as we give them their syringes. They know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. They weren't sharing because they wanted to share. They shared because there was scarcity. So I think that when you let people be who they want to be and you create conditions that cultivate safety for them, then they start to chatter among themselves and really experience the underlying, you know, who they, you know, all aspects of themselves, and that they're seeking pleasure. And so we try to create a situation here where we create enough safety so that there is the pursuit of pleasure is possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think not just, you look at the whole paradigm within U.S. culture, it's anti-pleasure. If you actually talk about the pleasure of drug use, if you talk about the pleasure of sex, you're somehow outside of the normal paradigm. It's your drugs are inherently bad, sex is inherently something you do secretly in a perverse way, and therefore you have to sublimate your sexual acts and stuff. And harm reduction is about embracing the pleasure within those things, because everyone does it. If everyone does it, it must there must be a reason why everyone does it. And harm reduction sort of embraces the pleasure side.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I mean, America has that split personality because it's really the paradigm of the... patriarchal paradigm is all about homo economicus, you know, making money, and it's all, everything is materialized and controlled, and the reproduction of money. And so pleasure plays a, you know, it's something that you want, you have to pay for, and it has to be, it's the pleasure is something that has to be commodified and turned into something that money can be, that you can exchange it and therefore control it. Because there's fear of pleasure, since, or that aspect of pleasure that can't be commodified. So the thing about...
You mean God gave you your own pleasure centers?
Yeah. Thank God. Thank the goddess for that. and, you know, thank, you know, we, of course, can... drug use is... We prohibit illicit drug use, but we don't prohibit drug use. So we prohibit illicit drug use because there's a bigger profit to be made around prohibition of illicit substances. It's not really, it's really, I think, about the money, and basically that's the core reason. But the second important reason is that if you have the freedom, you know, more and more what we see that the realm of freedom is shrinking to, you know, not just into our bedrooms, but if they can't commodify it, they have to figure out a way to distance us from it. And that is, that's just as old as institutionalized religion, right? I mean, it's not just something that just happened the other day. There is a real attempt to split you off from your pleasure, to tell you that you can't enjoy yourself. So you can't enjoy altered states, which is really not just pleasurable, but it's also exercising a power, and that's scary.
Right, and that ties into religion too, that the only way you can have an altered state of consciousness. It's actually through a priest or something like that. They'll do that for you. Anyway.
Well, at least Catholicism says that there's somebody there to do it. But, you know, the other ones, you know, they don't have intermediaries, but it's still, like, you know, taboo.
Okay, this is really great. I think we should end here. We should keep the door locked and find our pleasure centers.
Yay for finding the pleasure.
Thanks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. There'll be more next week. See you then.